Chapter 17. And those two American citizens shook hands on it with the greatest fervor, while I turned away, and received full in the eyes the brilliant wink of the Borkum Lighthouse squatting low down in the darkness. The shade of the night had settled on the North Sea. I do not think I have ever seen before a night so full of lights. The great change of sea life since my time was brought home to me. I had been conscious all day of an interminable procession of steamers. They went on and on, as if in chase of each other, the Baltic trade, the trade of Scandinavia, of Denmark, of Germany, pitching heavily into a head sea and bound for the gateway of Dover Straits. Singly, and in small companies of two and three, they emerged from the dull colorless sunless distances ahead, as if the supply of rather roughly finished mechanical toys were inexhaustible in some mysterious cheap store way there, below the gray curve of the earth. Cargo steam vessels have reached by this time a height of utilitarian ugliness which, when one reflects that it is the product of human ingenuity, strikes hopeless awe into one. These dismal creations look still uglier at sea than in port, and with an added touch of the ridiculous. Their rolling waddle when seen at a certain angle, their abrupt clockwork nodding in a sea way, so unlike the soaring lift and swing of a craft under sail, have in them something caricatural, a suggestion of a low parody directed at noble predecessors by an improved generation of dull mechanical toilers, conceited and without grace. When they switched on each of these unlovely cargo tanks carried tame lightning within its slab-sided body, when they switched on their lamps they spangled the night with the cheap, electric, shop glitter, here, there, and everywhere, as of some high street, broken up and washed out to sea. Later, Heligoland cut into the overhead darkness with its powerful beam, infinitely prolonged out of unfathomable night under the clouds. I remained on deck until we stopped, and a steam pilot boat, so overlighted amidships, that one could not make out her complete shape, glided across our bows, and sent a pilot on board. I fear that the oar, as a working implement, will become presently as obsolete as the sail. The pilot boarded us in a motor dinghy. More and more is mankind reducing its physical activities to pulling levers and twirling little wheels. Progress. Yet the older methods of meeting natural forces demanded intelligence too, an equally fine readiness of wits. And readiness of wits working in combination with the strength of muscles made a more complete man. It was really a surprisingly small dinghy, and it ran to and fro like a water insect fussing noisily down there with immense self-importance. Within hail of us the hull of the Elbe lightship floated all dark and silent under its enormous round service lantern, a faithful black shadow watching the broad estuary full of lights. Such was my first view of the Elbe approached under the wings of peace ready for flight away from the luckless shores of Europe. Our visual impressions remain with us so persistently that I find it extremely difficult to hold fast to the rational belief that now everything is dark over there, that the Elbe lightship has been towed away from its post of duty, the triumphant beam of Heligoland extinguished, and the pilot boat laid up, or turned to warlike uses for lack of its proper work to do. And obviously it must be so. Any trickle of oversea trade that passes, yet that way must be creeping along cautiously with the unlighted, war-blighted black coast close on one hand, and sudden death on the other. For all the space we steamed through that Sunday evening must now be one great minefield, sown thickly with the seeds of hate, while submarines steal out to sea, over the very spot perhaps, where the insect dinghy put a pilot on board of us with so much fussy importance. Mines. Submarines. The last word in sea warfare. Progress impressively disclosed by this war. There have been other wars. Wars not inferior in the greatness of the stake, and in the fierce animosity of feelings. During that one which was finished 100 years ago it happened that, while the English fleet was keeping watch on Brest, an American, perhaps Fulton himself, offered to the maritime prefect of the port, and to the French admiral, an invention which would sink all the unsuspecting English ships one after another, or, at any rate, most of them. The offer was not even taken into consideration, and the prefect ends his report to the minister in Paris with a fine phrase of indignation. Tea is not the sort of death one would deal to brave men. And behold, before history had time to hatch another war of the like proportions in the intensity of aroused passions and the greatness of issues, the death flavor of archaism descended on the manly sentiment of those self-denying words. Mankind has been demoralized, since by its own mastery of mechanical appliances. Its spirit is apparently so weak now, and its flesh has grown so strong, that it will face any deadly horror of destruction, and cannot resist the temptation to use any stealthy, murderous contrivance. It has become the intoxicated slave of its own detestable ingenuity. It is true, too, that since the Napoleonic time another sort of war doctrine has been inculcated in a nation, and held out to the world. IV, on this journey of ours, which for me was essentially not a progress, but a retracing of footsteps on the road of life, I had no beacons to look for in Germany. I had never lingered in that land which, on the whole, is so singularly barren of memorable manifestations of generous sympathies and magnanimous impulses. An ineradicable, invincible, provincialism of envy and vanity clings to the forms of its thought like a frozen garment. Even while yet very young I turned my eyes away from it instinctively, as from a threatening phantom. I believe that children and dogs have, in their innocence, a special power of perception as far as spectral apparitions and coming misfortunes are concerned. I let myself be carried through Germany, as if it were pure space, without sights, without sounds. No whispers of the war reached my voluntary abstraction. And perhaps not so very voluntary after all. Each of us is a fascinating spectacle to himself, and I had to watch my own personality returning from another world, as it were, to revisit the glimpses of old moons. Considering the condition of humanity, I am, perhaps, not so much to blame for giving myself up to that occupation. We prize the sensation of our continuity, and we can only capture it in that way. By watching. We arrived in Krakow late at night. After a scrambly supper, I said to my eldest boy, "I can't go to bed. I am going out for a look round. Coming?" He was ready enough. For him, all this was part of the interesting adventure of the whole journey. We stepped out of the portal of the hotel into an empty street, very silent and bright with moonlight. I was, indeed, revisiting the glimpses of the moon. I felt so much like a ghost, that the discovery, that I could remember such material things as the right turn to take, and the general direction of the street, gave me a moment of wistful surprise. The street, straight and narrow, ran into the great market square of the town, the center of its affairs, and of the lighter side of its life. We could see at the far end of the street a promising widening of space. At the corner an unassuming, but armed, policeman, wearing ceremoniously at midnight a pair of white gloves which made his big hands extremely noticeable, turned his head to look at the grizzled foreigner holding forth in a strange tongue to a youth on whose arm he leaned. The square, immense in its solitude, was full to the brim of moonlight. The garland of lights at the foot of the houses seemed to burn at the bottom of a bluish pool. I noticed with infinite satisfaction that the unnecessary trees the municipality insisted upon sticking between the stones had been steadily refusing to grow. They were not a bit bigger than the poor victims I could remember. Also, the paving operation seemed to be exactly at the same point at which I left them 40 years before. There were the dull, torn-up patches on that bright expanse, the piles of paving material looking ominously black, like heads of rocks on a silvery sea. Who was it that said that time works wonders? What an exploded superstition! As far as these trees and these paving stones were concerned, it had worked nothing, The suspicion of the unchangeableness of things already vaguely suggested to my senses by our rapid drive from the railway station was agreeably strengthened within me. We are now on the line A. BB, I said to my companion, importantly. It was the name bestowed in my time on one of the sites of the square by the senior students of that town of classical learning and historical relics. The common citizens knew nothing of it, and, even if they had, would not have dreamed of taking it seriously. He who used it was of the initiated, belonged to the schools. We youngsters regarded that name as a fine jest, the invention of a most excellent fancy. Even as I uttered it to my boy, I experienced again that sense of my privileged initiation. And then, happening to look up at the wall, I saw in the light of the corner lamp, a white, cast-iron tablet fixed thereon, bearing an inscription in raised black letters, thus, INA, BB. Heavens! The name had been adopted officially. Any town urchin, any gutter-snip, any herb-selling woman of the marketplace, any wandering Boeotian, was free to talk of the line A. BB, to walk on the line A. BB, to appoint to meet his friends on the line AB. It had become a mere name in a directory. I was stunned by the extreme mutability of things. Time could work wonders, and no mistake. A municipality had stolen an invention of excellent fancy, and a fine jest had turned into a horrid piece of cast iron. I proposed that we should walk to the other end of the line, using the profane name, not only without gusto, but with positive distaste. And this, too, was one of the wonders of time, for a bare minute had worked that change. There was at the end of the line a certain street I wanted to look at, I explained to my companion. To our right the unequal massive towers of St. Mary's Church soared aloft into the ethereal radiance of the air, very black on their shaded sides, glowing with a soft phosphorescent sheen on the others. In the distance the Florian Gate, thick and squat under its pointed roof, barred the street with the square shoulders of the old city wall. In the narrow, brilliantly pale vista of bluish flagstones and silvery fronts of houses, its black archway stood out small and very distinct. There was not a soul in sight, and not even the echo of a footstep for our ears. Into this coldly illuminated and dumb emptiness there issued out of my aroused memory, a small boy of 11, wending his way, not very fast, to a preparatory school for day pupils on the second floor of the third house down from the Florian Gate. It was in the winter months of 1868. At 8 o'clock of every morning that God made, sleet or shine, I walked up Florian Street. But of that, my first school, I remember very little. I believe that one of my co-sufferers there has become a much appreciated editor of historical documents. But I didn't suffer much from the various imperfections of my first school. I was rather indifferent to school troubles. I had a private gnawing worm of my own. This was the time of my father's last illness. Every evening at 7, turning my back on the Florian Gate, I walked all the way to a big old house in a quiet narrow street a good distance beyond the great square. There, in a large drawing room, paneled and bare, with heavy cornices and a lofty ceiling, in a little oasis of light made by two candles, in a desert of dusk, I sat at a little table, to worry and ink myself all over till the task of my preparation was done. The table of my toil faced a tall white door, which was kept closed. Now and then it would come ajar, and a nun in a white coif would squeeze herself through the crack, glide across the room, and disappear. There were two of these noiseless nursing nuns. Their voices were seldom heard. For, indeed, what could they have had to say? When they did speak to me, it was with their lips hardly moving, in a claustral, clear whisper. Our domestic matters were ordered by the elderly housekeeper of our neighbor on the second floor, a canon of the cathedral, lent for the emergency. She, too, spoke but seldom. She wore a black dress with a cross hanging by a chain on her ample bosom. And though when she spoke she moved her lips more than the nuns, she never let her voice rise above a peacefully murmuring note. The air around me was all piety, resignation, and silence. I don't know what would have become of me if I had not been a reading boy. My prep finished, I would have had nothing to do but sit and watch the awful stillness of the sick room flow out through the closed door and coldly enfold my scared heart. I suppose that in a futile, childish way I would have gone crazy. But I was a reading boy. There were many books about, lying on consoles, on tables, and even on the floor, for we had not had time to settle down. I read. What did I not read? Sometimes the elder nun, gliding up and casting a mistrustful look on the open pages, would lay her hand lightly on my head and suggest in a doubtful whisper, "Perhaps it is not very good for you to read these books." I would raise my eyes to her face mutely, and with a vague gesture of giving it up, she would glide away. Later in the evening, but not always, I would be permitted to tiptoe into the sick room, to say goodnight to the figure prone on the bed, which often could not acknowledge my presence, but by a slow movement of the eyes, put my lips dutifully to the nerveless hand lying on the coverlet, and tiptoe out again. Then I would go to bed, in a room at the end of the corridor, and often, not always, cry myself into a good sound sleep. I looked forward to what was coming with an incredulous terror. I turned my eyes from it sometimes with success, and yet all the time I had an awful sensation of the inevitable. I had also moments of revolt which stripped off me some of my simple trust in the government of the universe. But when the inevitable entered the sick room, and the white door was thrown wide open, I don't think I found a single tear to shed. I have a suspicion that the canon's housekeeper looked on me as the most callous little wretch on earth. The day of the funeral came in due course, and all the generous youth of the schools, the grave senate of the university, the delegations of the trade guilds, might have obtained, if they cared, divisive evidence of the callousness of the little wretch. There was nothing in my aching head but a few words, some such stupid sentences as, "It's done," or "comma, it's accomplished," in Polish it is much shorter, or something of the sort, repeating itself endlessly. The long procession moved out of the narrow street, down a long street, past the Gothic front of St. Mary's under its unequal towers, towards the Florian Gate. In the moonlight-flooded silence of the old town of glorious tombs and tragic memories, I could see again the small boy of that day following a hearse, a space kept clear in which I walked alone, conscious of an enormous following, the clumsy swaying of the tall black machine, the chanting of the surpliced clergy at the head, the flames of tapers passing under the low archway of the gate, the rows of bared heads on the pavements with fixed, serious eyes. Half the population had turned out on that fine May afternoon. They had not come to honor a great achievement, or even some splendid failure. The dead and they were victims alike of an unrelenting destiny which cut them off from every path of merit and glory. They had come only to render homage to the ardent fidelity of the man whose life had been a fearless confession in word and deed of a creed which the simplest heart in that crowd could feel and understand. It seemed to me that, if I remained longer there in that narrow street, I should become the helpless prey of the shadows I had called up. They were crowding upon me, enigmatic and insistent in their clinging air of the grave, that tasted of dust, and of the bitter vanity of old hopes. "Let's go back to the hotel, my boy," I said. "Tea's getting late." It will be easily understood that I neither thought nor dreamt that. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.